finishing the hat. How you have to finish the hat. How you watch the rest of the world from a window while you finish the hat.
Finishing the Hat is a song about the exhilarating, consuming process of creating a piece of art and the personal toll it can take. It's from Stephen Sondheim's Broadway musical, Sunday in the Park with George, inspired by a painting by George Seurat.
And how you're always turning back too late from the grass or the stick or the dog or the light. How the kind of woman willing to wait's not the kind that you want to find waiting to return you to the night. Tis a from the heart, coming from the heart.
Stephen Sondheim is himself a colossal force of creativity. Lin-Manuel Miranda calls him musical theater's greatest lyricist, full stop. When Miranda had the idea for Hamilton, it was Sondheim he turned to for support and counsel. On this episode, Sondheim talks about how he learned to create lyrics and music and some of the most enduring shows in the history of musical theater. The first lesson came from his dad.
My father played piano by ear, and I used to... My father would play, he loved Broadway shows, and he would come home and approximate the songs on the piano, and he would put his hands on the keys, and he put my hand, when I was tiny, on the melody, because he always played the melody with his little finger in the top.
This is What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adam A., this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
Stephen Sondheim's contributions to American musical theater are hard to exaggerate. Early in his career, he wrote the lyrics for West Side Story and Gypsy, and that alone would make him one of the greats. But add A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Company, Follies, A Little Night Music, Sweeney Todd, Assassins, Into the Woods, or Passion, just to name some highlights, and you're talking about a genius. Sondheim recorded a conversation with the Academy of Achievement in Los Angeles in 2005. The interviewer was journalist Gail Eichenthal. Sondheim told her that one of his first childhood memories is listening to his parents' music on a record player, but not just any record player.
We had a Capehart phonograph, which was a very elaborate mechanism in which 78s, which, you know, were recorded 3 minutes on a side. And so you had to turn them over by hand, but this machine turned the record over by a very clever mechanical device, and I used to just watch it, and I think that's how I got into music. I also took piano lessons when I was 6 and 7, but that's because what every nice upper-middle-class Jewish boy did in New York City. And so it was really, so the parents could show me off to their guests playing Flight of the Bumblebee and that sort of thing. And then I didn't want to go on with it. And then I played the organ when I went to military school when I was 10 years old. They had a huge, in fact, I believe it was the second largest pipe organ in New York State. And I loved all the buttons and the gadgets because I've always been a gadget man. My feet could hardly hit the pedals, but I played, and that was fun for a year. And then I took piano lessons when I was in prep school, when I was 15 and 16, and 14 and 15, and gave recitals around Pennsylvania. But I was not, They wanted me to be a concert pianist because I have a very good right hand, but my left hand's terrible and I hated performing.
Just to back up here, yes, you heard that correctly. Stephen Sondheim attended military school when he was 10 years old, and he loved it. Loved knowing, he says, that he had to be somewhere at 10:03 and do something at 11:07. He found comfort in that kind of precision. He also had a real affinity, like many musicians, for mathematics. Books, on the other hand.
I was never much of a reader, so much so that when I got to college, I took every novel course I could get my hands on to try to get into the habit of reading. And to this day, I'm just not a reader. I'm a slow reader, which is unusual because I'm so into language and I love words so much, but it's hard for me to read. I fell into lyric writing because of the music and because of Oscar. I backed into it.
Oscar. This is where the story grows wings. Oscar is Oscar Hammerstein, as in Oklahoma, Carousel, South Pacific, The King and I, The Sound of Music, that Oscar. When Sondheim was a child, he lived next door to him.
My parents got divorced when I was 10, and so I went to live in Pennsylvania with my mother, who got custody of me, and she cultivated the Hammersteins, and they had a son my age. And so by the time I was 13, I was already interested in imitating Oscar.
Stephen Sondheim once said that if Oscar Hammerstein had been a geologist, he'd be studying rocks today instead of writing music and lyrics.
He was a surrogate father. I liked my father a lot. He was a swell fellow, but I didn't see him very often because my mother was bitter about him and did everything she could to prevent me from seeing him in the court, of course. He remarried. And I used to have to sneak off to see them because I didn't know, but my mother was lying to me about how often I could see him. But so it was very unpleasant. But so Oscar was a surrogate father during, you know, all those many days and weeks and months when I didn't see my own father.
Seems like providence that a boy like that, one with such prodigious talents, should have come into the orbit of a man who wrote 850 songs and shaped musical theater for a good chunk of the 20th century.
Yeah, I suppose it's amazing. It's not as amazing as when you think that my mother wanted me off her hands. She was a working woman, and she designed clothes, and she was a celebrity collector, and they had a son my age. So, I mean, there are a series of circumstances that come together. It's not so much luck, it's my mother's ambition to be a celebrity. She was a very talented dress designer. And my father was a dress manufacturer. And I have a feeling that marriage was one of convenience. I think she was in love with him, but I don't think he felt about her the way she did about him. And it's all speculation, the way I look back on it. She was a difficult woman, and I don't think he was very happy with being married to her.
Being her son was no picnic either, evidently. Luckily, Oscar Hammerstein offered refuge and inspiration. During that period, adolescence, Stephen Sondheim made his first foray into musical theater as a student at the prestigious George School on the outskirts of Philadelphia.
I wrote a show at George School called By George, and it was all about local campus activities. But I was 15, I thought it was so terrific that I was sure that Rodgers and Hammerstein, who were producers as well as writers, would want to produce it immediately, and I would be the youngest songwriter on Broadway. And so I asked him if he would read it, and he said sure. And so he called me the next day, and I went over, and I said, now, you know, I want you to really treat this like a professional, as if you didn't know me, as if it just crossed your desk. And he said, all right. In that case, it's the worst thing that ever crossed my desk. And I was shocked, and he knew how disappointed I was, to put it mildly. He said, now, I didn't say it wasn't talented, he said, but if you want to go through it, I'll tell you what's wrong with it. And he started right from the first stage direction, and he treated me like an adult. He treated me as if I were a professional. And by the end of the afternoon, I was on my way to being a professional. And he gave me, you know, the distillation of 30 years of experience. Now, not all in that afternoon, because then he set up a course for me, so to speak. He said, if you want to learn to write music, why don't you take a good play one that you like and make it into a musical. And then, after you've done that, then take a play that you like but you think is flawed and see if you can improve it and turn it into a musical. Then take a story, not one that you've written, but that is not in the dramatic form, like a novel or something like that, make it into a musical, and then make up your own story and make it into a musical. And he said, by the time you get all those four done, you'll know something. And that's exactly what I did.
It was quite an assignment for a 15-year-old, one that took him 6 or 7 years to complete. Along the way, though, he got a ringside seat to one of the greatest artistic collaborations of all time.
When I was 17, he was going to, it was their third show. They'd written Oklahoma and Carousel, Rodgers and Hammerstein. And Oscar asked me if I'd like to work on it because they were rehearsing over the summer, which was between terms for me. So that's exactly what I did. I was a gopher, fetched coffee and typed a script. And he just wanted me to inculcate my, stuff. And I learned a great deal watching because particularly the show was highly experimental and it was a failure. And both those things were very important to me because one of the things I learned was to be brave and the other thing, not to expect that everything's going to come out perfectly. Also, it was very, very much hurt by the director, Agnes DeMille, and I learned something about gotta watch out for directors.
There were lots of other lessons, too. So what else did he learn from his neighbor and role model and teacher, Oscar Hammerstein?
Oh, goodness. Virtually everything. Structure, don't forget, his particular, people mistake or underestimate what he did in the way of musical theater. He was primarily an experimental writer. And what he was doing was marrying the traditions of opera and American musical comedy, using songs to tell a story that was worth telling. The first real instance of that is Showboat, which is a watershed show in terms of the history of musical theater. And Oklahoma, which is in the same way, though in different ways, I should say, innovative. But it's only one way of writing songs. He believed in dramatic songwriting. So what I learned from him was, how to tell a story in song, which is not what Cole Porter was doing or Rodgers and Hart. There are other ways to write songs and other uses of them. Now, because of the success of Oklahoma and subsequent shows, most musical theater now tell stories through songs, but that was not true prior to 1943, and it was the year of Oklahoma. But he also taught me how to structure a song. He taught me the use of a rhyme, everything, and about character, inconsistencies, what is effective on a stage. Concision, all kinds of things. He was technically, very, very good. His writing today particularly seems somewhat naive, but not if you look at it technically, and certainly not from the use of the imagination. His imagination, his creative imagination was far more sophisticated than the work itself and has affected the theater permanently.
There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. The corn is as high as an elephant's eye, and it looks like it's climbing clear up to the sky. Oh, what a beautiful morning.
His kind of lyric writing was very much understated lyric writing. His lyrics don't read very well. They sing when they're good, they sing great. But whereas if you read Cole Porter's, they're very entertaining. Oh, What a Beautiful Morning, simply when you put it on paper, looks vapid, but it's not when it's sung. He understood, that's another thing he understood, which is how rich music is, and lyrics have to be underwritten. That's why poets generally make poor lyric writers. Not always, but generally they do, because the language is too rich. It's like what they call in England egging the, goodness, I can't remember what the noun is, not egging the cake, but it's over enriching something. so that you get drowned in it instead of, you know, I firmly believe the lyrics have to breathe and give the audience a chance and give the audience's ear a chance to understand what's going on. Well, particularly in the theater where you not only have the music, but you've got costume, story, acting, orchestra, there's a lot to take in. And if the lyrics are too packed, I mean, the whole idea of poetry is denseness, is concision, is abutment of images and that sort of thing. You can't do that when you've got music going and expect the audience to take it in.
Tonight, tonight, it all began tonight. I saw you and the world went away. Tonight.
Stephen Sondheim had absorbed and developed enough wisdom that by the time he got his first serious gig as a lyricist, he was already extraordinary. But the story behind West Side Story requires a little backstory. A couple of years out of college, Sondheim was hired to write three songs for a musical that was aborted before it made it to the stage. But that gave him a portfolio, and it brought him out to California. That's where he landed his first regular paying job, not in musicals, but as an assistant writer on a television show called Topper. The head writer of Topper knew that what Sondheim really wanted to do was to work in musical theater. So, in Hollywood style, he connected him to some people who connected him to some people who were adapting the novel Serenade for Broadway. They needed a new composer because Leonard Bernstein had dropped out of the project. Sondheim auditioned with the score and songs he'd written for the previous show, and in the room was Arthur Lawrence, who was writing the book for Serenade. The book in musical theater is basically the libretto, the story, the characters, the dialogue, all the things that are architecture for the songs. And if you don't already know the name Arthur Lawrence, remember it now. Lawrence was impressed by Sondheim's audition, but then the Serenade project got scrapped when a movie studio came out with the film version first. So this musicals endeavor wasn't yielding results yet for Stephen Sondheim, but at least he had his TV gig. Many months later, he was invited to a party where he spotted Arthur Lawrence.
And we chatted just to make small talk. And I asked him what he was doing. He said he was about to start on a musical version of Romeo and Juliet. And I said, who's writing? He said, Leonard Bernstein. And he said, I think Betty and Adolph, meaning Comden and Green, except we can't, they're not sure they can get out of a Hollywood contract. We'll know in a week. And he said, you know, I never thought of you. If they don't do, would you like to audition for Bernstein? Because I loved your lyrics. He said, I didn't like your music very much. He said, it's Saturday night, but I loved your lyrics, he said. And I said, sure. And I didn't really want to write just lyrics, but I wanted to meet Leonard Bernstein. And so I met him the next day and I played for him. And he said, I'll call you in a week and let you know about Comden and Green. First of all, I assumed that Comden and Green would be able easily to get out of their contract. And secondly, I didn't want to write just lyrics. Because music was always my first reason I was writing songs. And sure enough, the phone rang. And I said, let me get back to you. And I went to Oscar and said, you know, I really just want to write, I want to write music, but he said, take the job. He said, first of all, these are really experienced and talented men, Bernstein and Robbins and Lawrence, and you'll learn a lot, and so you'll write music later.
And that's just what he did. Oscar Hammerstein's advice, as always, impeccable.
A boy like that would kill your brother. Forget that boy and find another. One of your own kind, stick to your own kind. A boy like that will bring you sorrow. You'll meet another boy tomorrow. One of your own kind, stick to your own kind. A boy who kills cannot love. A boy who kills has no heart. And he's the boy who gets your love and gets your heart.
West Side Story brought together a perfect storm of talents. The original idea was famously Jerome Robbins, the choreographer and director of West Side Story.
He wanted to do Romeo and Juliet because I think he was coaching Montgomery Clift in a scene or something. He got the idea of doing Romeo and Juliet and to do it between Catholics and Jews on the Lower East Side. And he enlisted Arthur and Lenny, and Arthur felt that, this is Arthur's account anyway, that it would just be AB's Irish Rose set to music. And so then they were all out here in California, apparently sitting around the Beverly Hills pool, and they picked up a newspaper, and there was a headline about gang warfare in New York and Puerto Rican street gangs. And the figurative light went on or something like that, and they decided, I don't know what the gap of years was between that and when they started writing it, but that then became the genesis.
When Stephen Sondheim was brought on board to write lyrics, Leonard Bernstein was nervous about taking a chance on this newcomer, so the plan was they'd be co-lyricists. Financially, what that meant was that the 4% of gross that composer and lyricist typically earned would be split. Bernstein would get 3%, Sondheim 1%. But by the time the show opened for a trial run in Washington, D.C., all the lyrics were Sondheim's, with the exception of a line or two.
And Lenny said, "We'll even out because you deserve blah, blah, blah." And I foolishly said, "Oh, don't be silly. All I care about is the credit." Somebody should have stuffed a handkerchief in my mouth because it would have been nice to get that extra percent.
Yeah, 1% of West Side Story's earnings, a lot of money. But of course, the credit Sondheim got as solo lyricist was invaluable, as was the experience of working with Leonard Bernstein.
Fun, a lot of fun, and we had numerous shared tastes, particularly British crossword puzzles, which in fact I introduced him to, and anagrams. We played Cutthroat Anagrams, which was the way we'd get off any kind of hidden hostility. It was never any overt hostility at all, and he liked working with somebody who knew music, who was a musician. He had never written with somebody who was a musician before, and the main difference was he liked to work together in a room and I liked to work separately, so we compromised. We like separate for 2 days and then we'd get together on the third day. We talked on the phone a lot. It could not have been a better and more stimulating and good collaboration. A great time.
Boy, boy, crazy boy, stay loose, boy. Buzz it, easy does it, turn off the juice, boy.
One of the other great collaborators on West Side Story, who would go on to create a number of hit shows with Sondheim, was the producer, Hal Prince. Sondheim brought him into the fold after the original producer, Cheryl Crawford, dropped out at the last minute, making one of the bigger mistakes of her career.
She suddenly got cold feet. And so there we were, knowing that we had to get the show on by September because Lenny was unavailable starting in September. And so I had urged them to give the show earlier to Hal Prince and his partner Bobby Griffith, but though they had done two successful shows, Pajama Game and Damn Yankees, Lenny and Jerry and Arthur didn't feel that they were experienced enough, so they preferred Cheryl. When Cheryl dropped out, I called Hal myself, who was out of town with a show called New Girl in Town, which was not going well. And so he was more than anxious to start a new project. However, I had played him the score before, and he did not like the show, West Side. But because of that moment, catching him in a vulnerable thing, and knowing that the minute the show opened in New York, he would have something else to work on, it softened him up.
Hal Prince told the Academy of Achievement in 2007 that he first met Stephen Sondheim at Richard Rodgers' house on Christmas Eve. Rodgers was Hammerstein's collaborator, of course, and in due time, Hal Prince would become Stephen Sondheim's. It's a web of musical theater royalty, for sure.
The phone rang in Boston, and I was in the hotel, and Steve Sondheim called, and I told him my problems. Never occurred to me to ask him what his were, but ours were minimal compared, because we were struggling to get get the show finished to come to Broadway, where it did, ultimately, a couple of weeks later. But then when I was finished, he said, we've lost our producer, we have no show, being West Side Story. So I said, wow, that's just the worst. And I said, if Bobby and I flew in, we have to give the cast off on Sunday. If we flew into New York, could you, Lenny, Jerry, and Arthur Lawrence, who'd written the book really well, could we all meet and Bobby hear the score and I hear the score again? Lenny had told everyone no one was to ever hear this score. And I knew every note of the score because Steve was my friend and he'd play it all the time. So I knew it all. But I had to pretend that I'd never heard any of it. So we went to Lenny's apartment, and they were all there on that Sunday. And Lenny was nervous. He'd never heard anybody pound so loudly on the piano, just in an effort to please. And Steve sang some of the lyrics with Lenny. And it was just as thrilling as anything can be. And I started to sing along inadvertently, and Lenny stopped, and nervous pause, and then he said, that's what I've always been looking for, is a musical producer. And that's how he got away with it.
Hal Prince and Stephen Sondheim have somewhat different recollections of West Side Story's opening night.
Oh, it's just thrilling. You knew right away. My memory is that the only thing that ever got fiddled around with forever was Somewhere, which was a song top of the second act where Riri Griss, the opera singer, sat in the pit and sang. She wasn't seen by the audience, and there was a whole big ballet between the Jets and the Sharks, and that just got fiddled with and fiddled with and fiddled with until it finally we had to open. But it was quite thrilling.
No, the audience sat there in dead silence for the first half hour because the reviews from out of town had made it sound like some kind of masterpiece. And so the audience was awestruck when they came in, instead of remembering that they were at a musical. And so there was virtually no response. They just sat there as at a temple. And then America came on, and Cheetah Rivera lifted her skirts and danced all over the stage, and the audience suddenly were reminded they were at a musical. And from then on, they had a very good time.
I like the city of San Juan. I know a boat you can get on. Hundreds of flowers in full bloom.
Hundreds of people in each room.
Automobile in America. Chromium tea in America. Wire for we in America. Very big deal in America.
Interviewer Gail Eichenthal told Stephen Sondheim that she was shocked to read that he wished he could rewrite the lyrics. Since it's probably my all-time favorite musical, I found his response even more shocking.
I don't want to rewrite them. They're just not very good. That's a difference. They're very self-conscious lyrics. You can smell the writer. They're, you know, instead of the characters, they're obviously coming from the writer. Now, the whole play, and the book, which I think is brilliant because of how much it accomplishes in such a brief time, is also arch. I mean, very stylized language. So I was justified. But, as I said before about lyrics, music blows lyrics up very quickly. And suddenly they become more than arch. They become pompous and they become self-conscious. I like Something's Coming, and I like the Jets song, and that about, and a couple of other moments, but that's about it.
When you're a Jet, you're a Jet, all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day. When you're a Jet, if the spit hits the fan, you got brothers around, you're a family man. You're never alone, you're never disconnected, you're home with your own. When company's expected, you're well protected.
Sondheim tells the story of a critical moment in his musical theater education that came during the writing of West Side Story. Leonard Bernstein was out of town, and so Sondheim had to go talk to the director, Jerome or Jerry Robbins, by himself about one of the key numbers.
We'd finished the song Maria, and I went up to play it for Jerry, and Jerry said, well, after he'd heard it, he said, well, yeah, that's all fine, but what's he doing? I said, what do you mean, what's he doing? He said, what's the character doing?
I said, he's singing a song. I mean, you know, he's standing there like you do in musicals and you sing a song. He said, well, how would you like to stage it? He said, because he was always quite hostile. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, tell me, stage it. Tell me what. I said, well, and I realized what he was saying, is that there should be some kind of stage action built into a song, that you should, as a songwriter, choreograph it yourself in some way, even if it's just a so-called static love song. And it was a very important lesson. I've always done that, which is why directors like working with me, because I always give them a blueprint from which they can either ignore or from which they can, or which they can use as a springboard. But there's always a blueprint. I never say, well, here's the number. I would say, here, he's sitting on a chair, he gets up, he pours himself a cup of coffee, he sings the first, whatever it is. And often, particularly when I worked with Hal Prince, I would get the dimensions of the set, so I would know how long it took a character to get from X to Y, and write accordingly, so the director isn't suddenly stuck with saying, I need 8 more bars.
Before Sondheim's extraordinarily fertile period of collaboration with Hal Prince really took off, there were other shows of note. Here's a rundown, starting with Gypsy in 1959, which followed West Side Story, and which some critics maintain is the greatest musical of all time. Sondheim got the gig as lyricist after Cole Porter and Irving Berlin turned it down. So who got the last laugh there?
You'll be swell, you'll be great, gonna have the whole world on a plate.
Funny thing happened on the way to the Forum was the first show where Sondheim finally got his wish to work as composer as well as lyricist. That was in 1962.
Something familiar, something peculiar, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Something appealing, something appalling, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Nothing with kings.
Then came Anyone Can Whistle, another collaboration with Arthur Lawrence, which, after the previews, lasted just 9 performances.
I thought I'd be devastated the first time I had a big flop, but I wasn't. You're disappointed. And it sounds mealy-mouthed to say, but it's true. My main disappointment is that people I want to see it aren't going to get a chance to see it.
Everybody says don't, everybody says stop, everybody says mustn't rock the boat, mustn't touch a thing. Everybody says don't, everybody says wait, everybody says can't fight City Hall, can't upset the con, can't laugh at the king. Well, I say try, I say laugh at the kings or they'll make you cry, lose your poise. If you have to, but lady, make a noise.
Says, and then in 1965, Do I Hear a Waltz, where he wrote the lyrics for Richard Rodgers' music. That show did better, but it wasn't a happy experience for Sondheim.
He was at the sort of the end of his creative career. It was very difficult working with him because he was afraid to rewrite. He was afraid that he'd reach the bottom of the well. And, you know, I'm one of those believers that that writing is a matter of rewriting. And if he would resist any change in a song, and because he was afraid that if he tried to rewrite something, he'd come up empty. He was a very paranoid man, so that was another problem, because Arthur and I were great friends. We collaborated a lot, Arthur Lawrence. And it was based on a play of Arthur's. Rodgers was the producer, so he had the whip hand. And so it became this kind of feud, which it only surfaced as such a few times, but it was always there. Oh, at one point, he tore up a lyric of mine that I worked 36 hours on in front of the whole cast and called it a piece of shit. When I first started work with him, he had a great time working with me because, again, I was a musician, and he had never worked with a musician. And so we had a common language. And the kind of lyrics I was writing had an echo of heart in them because they were kind of hip. But the story's a sentimental one. And so and over a period of time, and particularly when we got out of town and the show didn't work very well. And then he went berserk.
Finally, in 1970, Stephen Sondheim teamed back up with his old friend, director Hal Prince, and the collaboration was epic. They worked hand in glove for over a decade, creating the shows Company, Follies, A Little Night Music, Pacific Overtures, Sweeney Todd, and Merrily We Roll Along. Sondheim described their magic this way.
Stimulating and funny, and we were friends for a long time, too. The primary thing about Hal, for me, is his enthusiasm and impatience. I'm a low flame, and he's a high flame. And that's one of the things that makes us a good team. Coming away from any meeting with Hal or a discussion on the phone or anything like that, I always want to write.
Another 100 people just got off of the train and came up through the ground, while another 100 people just got off of the bus and are looking around at another 100 people who got off of the plane and are looking at us who got off of the train and the plane and the bus maybe yesterday. It's a city of strangers. Some come to work, some to play. A city of strangers. Some come to stare, some to stay. And every day, the ones who stay.
Their shows came fast and furious. They were experimental and innovative in both form and content. But in 1981, with Merrily We Roll Along, that partnership came to an end, or at least it took a long pause. And since Sondheim's story, like all of musical theater's story, is the story of collaborations, the next chapter belongs to James Lapine.
I'd seen a play that he wrote and directed called 12 Dreams and was knocked out by it and wanted to collaborate with him. And by coincidence, he wanted to collaborate with me, and we were brought together by a producer named Lou Allen. And James was of a generation below me, and not just in age, but in approach to theater. He came from off-Broadway. That's where his stuff was done. The plays had been done. And a much more loose, I won't say improvisatory, because his plays are very carefully written, but in not-for-profit theater, you don't worry so much about, how the audience is going to react. You want to absorb them. To make them absorbed in the piece, but we had to get to know each other, and we discussed movies we liked. We realized that we operate on the same levels in many ways, and he had been a photographer and a graphics designer, and he would bring up photographs, some of which he'd taken out of magazines, and just spread them out on the floor just to see how they abutted, which is exactly the reverse of how I'd ever. You know, I'd been trained to start with a story, and you begin at the beginning. You know, but what he was doing was taking off from his imagination and seeing what would suddenly strike us. And one evening, we got to discussing. He had used this painting, the Seurat painting, in a play so-called he did by Gertrude Stein called Photograph, which is actually just a one-page scenario for a possible play. And we started talking about it, and I said, that whole thing has always looked like a stage set to me. And it also had started because he asked me what kind of show I might want to write. And I said, I want to write a theme and variations, which is the kind of show I've always wanted to write. And I brought him a magazine called Bizarre, which is Variations on the Mona Lisa. So we started talking about variations, and we started talking about this set. And James said, do you realize nobody in that picture, and there are 48 people or 50 people, is looking at anybody else? Why is that, do you suppose? I mean,
you're talking about in the Seurat.
In the Seurat, yeah, absolutely. And not that that's what Seurat meant, it just happens, and it does look like a stage set. Perhaps they're hiding from each other, and perhaps they're having illicit affairs, perhaps. And then he said, the main character's missing. I said, who? And he said, the artist. And once he said that, it was, again, the light bulb went off, and we knew we had a play in mind, because it's about a man who controls a landscape and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And once you say the artist is the main character, then you're talking, at least one of your themes is going to be about creativity.
That famous Seurat painting is pointillist. It's made of tiny dibs and dabs and dots of paint coming together to create a beautiful whole. And Sondheim says that is precisely what he and James Lapine were trying to do with the musical, juxtapose images, emotions, meaning, and character, so that they all finally fit together into a whole that tells a story. The original Broadway production in 1984 starred Mandy Patinkin and Bernadette Peters.
I've nothing to say.
You have many things.
Well, nothing that's not been said.
Said by you, though,
I
George.
Do not know where to go.
And nor did I.
I want to make things that count. Things that
I did what I had to do.
What am I to do?
Move on. Stop worrying where you're going. Move on. If you can know where you're going, you've gone. Just keep moving on. I chose and my world was shaken. So what? The choice may have been mistaken. The choosing was not. You have to move on.
Very few people liked the show. We were sneered at a great deal by the newspapers and by the public. Frank Rich, the critic for the New York Times, liked it a lot. He did not give it a rave on the opening act, but he was stimulated by it, and he kept coming back to see it and writing about it. So it became a sort of pet of the New York Times, which also raised a lot of hackles. But audiences were baffled by it. Many were. You know, a number of walkouts. And the Tonys, but you know, the Tonys ignored West Side Story. The Tonys ignored Gypsy. You know, the Tonys are they're not weird. They're worthless. And they're useless, except when they sell tickets, which they don't do anymore. And so we were disappointed, I suppose, by the Tonys because it's a kind of public humiliation.
But on the other hand, unbeknownst to Sondheim and Lapine, a choral director submitted Sunday in the Park with George to the Pulitzer Committee for consideration, and it won. Sondheim and Lapine followed that with Into the Woods, based on some Brothers Grimm fairy tales, and then Passion, which Sondheim has said is about how, quote, the force of somebody's feelings for you can crack you open, and how it is the life force in a deadened world.
Some say happiness comes and goes. Then this happiness is a kind of happiness no one really knows. I thought I knew what love was. I thought it was no more than a name for yearning.
I thought it was what kindness became.
I'm learning.
I thought where there was love, there was shame.
That with you.
But with you,
there's just happiness.
Endless happiness.
I want to leave the chronology for a while and return to Sondheim talking about the art, the craft, and the work of writing songs. And it's interesting to note that Sondheim finds lyrics a much greater challenge to write than music.
One of the hardest things about writing lyrics is to make the lyrics sit on the music in such a way that you're not aware there was a writer there, and that sounds natural. Well, that means things like inflection, the elongation of syllables. Now, I'm talking about a certain kind of song. You know, opera librettists and opera composers will take a word and do a whole melisma on it because it's not about the language. It's about the voice and music. But if you're dealing with a musical in which you're trying to tell a story that is like a play, and particularly if you're trying to tell a contemporary one or something in the last 50 years, it's got to sound like speech. And in order not to sound so song-like that you lose the scene. At the same time, it's got to be a song in the sense that I loathe recitative, and so it should have a form, and I think the form is what gives it power. And the more formal, in a sense, the song is. So you have to juggle all those things, and that's hard work. That's really hard. And usually it doesn't come out quite the way you want it. That may be true. Maybe all writers would say it never comes out the way you want it. It's particularly noticeable in a lyric because the form is so short. You know, you got 50 words. One of them out of place is like having a novel with one out of 50 chapters. out of place. But you got 49 long chapters, so that doesn't, but in a short period of time, it stands out, the wrong word. And because each word becomes so important.
Writing a song for a musical, Sondheim also says, is quite a bit like acting, because to do it well, you've got to explore and inhabit the character who will be singing it.
And the way you get in the song, both musically and lyrically, is to become the character. It's the only way. I don't know how else you do it. Unless you're the playwright who created the character in the first place. But I'm always writing for characters that somebody else has created, my collaborator. And so the only way I can get into it, I've said, and it's probably an exaggeration, but not much, that by the time I get through writing a score, I know the book better than the book writer does, because I've examined every word and questioned the book writer on every word. Why does she say this? Why doesn't she say that? And that's getting to know the character. And then writing the song is acting it, you know. So that can start ad-libbing. It's exactly like improvisatory acting. So here's the character of Blanche. We're hiring you to play Blanche. Okay, just veer from the Tennessee Williams script and just start ad-libbing as Blanche. If you're thoroughly in the character, you can do it. You may not have the poetry he has, but everything you say will be in the character of Blanche. That's what I do. I take off from what the book writer has written, and sometimes using a line of his as a springboard, and ad-lib and improvise as that character. I mean, that's what I'm doing.
Sometimes Sondheim even asks the book writer to write an extra monologue, not to be performed, but just to give him a better understanding of the character. But there's someone else Sondheim tries to get to know extremely well as he's working on a song, and that is the actor who will be bringing the character to life during the out-of-town trial runs and then on Broadway if all goes right.
You know your cast well, and you know their strengths and weaknesses, and you can start writing for them, just the way Shakespeare wrote for his actors. And I've said with heavy humor that I really don't want to write a score until the whole show is cast and staged, because that's why so many good songs get written out of town and written fast, because you know exactly what's missing, you know exactly what has to work or happen, you know exactly who you're writing for, you know exactly what the audience is starting to feel. It's all, you know, and so the more restrictions you have, the easier anything is to write. And when you're out of town and you're restricted by all those factors, it's much easier to write than when you just have a tabla rasa and say, gee, well, we got to have a love song here. You know, it's not the same thing.
A great case in point is the song Send in the Clowns, which Sondheim wrote in 1973 for A Little Night Music.
We hired Glynis Johns on playing the lead on the, though she had a nice little silvery voice, but I put all the vocal weight of the show on the other characters, because we needed somebody who was glamorous, charming, and could play light comedy and pretty. And to find that in combination with a good voice is very unlikely. And but she had all the right qualities and a nice little voice. So I didn't write much for her, and I didn't write anything in the second act. And the big scene between her and her ex-lover, I had started on a song for him because it's his scene. And Hal Prince, who directed it, said he thought that the second act needed a song for her. And this was the scene to do it in. And so he directed the scene in such a way that even though the dramatic thrust comes from the man's monologue, and she just sits there and reacts, he directed so you could feel the weight going to her reaction rather than his action. And I went down and saw it, and it seemed very clear what was needed, and so that made it very easy to write. And then I wrote it for her voice, because she couldn't sustain notes, so, because it wasn't that kind of singing voice, so I knew I had to write things in short phrases. And that led to questions, and that, you know. So it was, again, I wouldn't have written the song so quickly if I hadn't known the actress. I wrote most of it one night, and the whole thing was done in 2 days.
Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, you in midair.
Sondheim had no inkling, by the way, that he'd created something that would become a jazz standard and a hit record outside of the show he wrote it for, a hit record 3 times over for Frank Sinatra, for Judy Collins, and years later for Barbara Streisand.
Isn't it?
bliss. Don't you approve? One who keeps tearing around, one who can't move. Where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Just when I'd stopped opening doors. Again with my usual flair.
Sure. By that time, you know, hit songs did not come out of musicals. By that time, rock was creating the hits. There were very, 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 very few songs that made the charts in any way out of any Broadway musical. What a big, there was no hit from Fiddler on the Roof. Hello, Dolly may have been the only one. And so one didn't think in those terms. In the generation before me, the Rodgers and Hammerstein generation, that's why they plugged the song in Oklahoma, because popular hits came out of shows and movies. When I wrote Small World and Gypsy, Julie Stein, the composer, was very upset because he said, this can only be sung by a woman. And my friend Frank needs a song, Sinatra. That's the way he thought, because he'd come from a generation in which you put the song in the musical. If it worked for the story, great, but the important thing was that it should get recorded. And this was no longer true, so which was a great liberation, because it meant you could write about anything.
Getting back to the process Stephen Sondheim follows when he's writing songs, he explained that he first has to get to know the characters, he then has to get to know the actors, and he's got to do both while working in lockstep with his creative partners. But there comes a time in the production of every show when a whole new partner comes into the process, one you'll never see listed in your playbill.
Musicals are, particularly musicals, plays also, but musicals particularly, are the last collaborator is your audience. And so you got to wait till the last collaborator comes in before you can complete the collaboration. And when the audience comes in, it changes the temperature of what you've written. And things that seemed to work well work in the sense of carry the story forward and be integral to the piece suddenly become a little less relevant or a little less functional or a little overlong or a little overweight or a little whatever. And so you start reshaping in front of an audience.
Sometimes you even realize you need to let your most precious children go.
That's something I learned from Oscar. He and Rodgers had written a ballad for Oklahoma called Boys and Girls Like You and Me. And they played it in the overture, and they sang it in the first act, and they did it in the entr'acte, and then they reprised it in the second act. It was their big plug number to be a popular hit. And they dropped it in New Haven because it didn't serve the function in the show that it could, and that's ruthlessness. And I learned that from Oscar.
But, Sondheim warns aspiring lyricists out there, ruthlessness should not be confused with relentless self-criticism.
Every writer that I know of, that I've ever spoken to, feels fraudulent in some way or other. Sometimes you can be so self-critical you take the blood out of a piece. And that is often a danger. The worst thing you can do is censor yourself as the pencil hits the paper. It's particularly true in lyric writing because things become, you know, it's easy for a novelist to say, I love you. It's three words out of 300,000. But if that is in your lyric and you think, oh, Jesus, I can't say, no, that's just too flat and it's too clear. Well, if you start thinking that way, you won't write anything. And so, yeah, I know it from myself. That's why I always emphasize it, because it takes one to know one. It's that moment you must not edit until you get it all on paper. If you can possibly put everything down, stream of consciousness, no matter how cliched it may seem, you'll do yourself a service.
Sondheim's mention of pencil hitting paper brings up one last facet of his songwriting craft, the physical one. Where, when, and how does he write? Gail Eichenthal, our interviewer, often asks those questions when she's talking to a writer, and the answers are almost always revealing. With Sondheim, the discussion got into the real nitty-gritty.
I use Blackwing pencils. Blackwings, they don't make them anymore. And luckily, I bought a lot of boxes of them. They're very soft lead. Mm-hmm. They're not round, so they don't fall off the table, and they have removable erasers. And there is a whole community of people, I shouldn't say community, there is, all over the United States, there are people who only use Blackwings and who I sometimes get letters, do you have any source for the Blackwings? And Adam Green, Adolph Green's son, has written an article for the New Yorker, quite a long article on the Blackwing pencil and the fanatics who go crazy when they don't have a Blackwing in their hand.
This interview, remember, was recorded in 2005. As it turns out, 5 years later, Blackwing pencils went back into production. We didn't check back with Mr. Sondheim to see if his old stash had lasted long enough to carry him through, but we can only imagine it was welcome news. Unfortunately, the paper he liked to write on is still a thing of the past.
Yes, yellow line pads. I used to have them, so it was, I think, 26 lines. And my friend Bert Shevelov, who was a stationery freak, said, buy cartons of them. I said, oh, Bert, come on, I'll buy 12 pads. It'll be enough. I mean, that guy. Well, was he ever right? Because they discontinued making them about 20 years ago. And now I'm used to the other pads now. But when you get used to the exact amount of space between lines, because, you know, you write a word and then you write an alternate word over it, you want enough room so you can read it. So the lines can't be too close. But if they're too far apart, you don't get enough lines on the page. I could go on. It's all, I'm sure many writers have these tiny little habits. You just habituate it. Of course you can write. If I were forced, if there were no yellow pads in the world, I'd find a way of writing on white paper, you know, or on non-lined pad. It's the lined pads that make it. Yellow is just good because of the contrast of yellow and the black lead. It's just easier on the eyes than white.
And where does all this Blackwing pencil on yellow-lined pads of paper take place? Well, in two very contrasting kinds of spaces.
I have a studio. I now have a house in Connecticut as well as a place in New York, and so I have a studio in each place, and that's where I live my life. It's pleasanter to work in the country, where it's quiet and where you can wander out and among the trees, but I don't get as much work done. And in the city, there's more pressure. You don't want to leave the room because there's all that chaos going on. And so it's more like a monk's cell, in the sense that you're isolating yourself from the world. And that, I think, leads to more work. It's like doing homework. If you're forced not to leave a room, and of course I'm not forced, but I mean, think of it as a force, as something keeping me in the room. You eventually get bored enough, so you put the pencil to the paper. Rogers was famous for locking Larry Hart in rooms to get the lyrics.
For all the extraordinary collaboration Stephen Sondheim forged during his long career, in the end, he says, a writer's work is still a solitary affair. And that suits him just fine.
Gosh, there wasn't any problem for Bach. It's not always a problem. You're there with your own head. And a pencil or a brush or a piano. It's fun. I mean, if you like doing it. Otherwise, why are you doing it? It's finishing that. It's all about trancing out. And when you trance out properly, when the writing is, it's not necessarily going well, but when you're completely in that world, there is no other world. It's all in finishing that.
I'm just a Broadway baby.
That's Stephen Sondheim speaking to the Academy of Achievement in 2005. The first in a two-volume set of his lyrics is called Finishing the Hat. The second is called Look, I Made a Hat. Sondheim is the winner of a Pulitzer Prize, a Presidential Medal of Freedom, and umpteen Tony Awards, Drama Desk Awards, and Grammy Awards for work he has done over seven decades in musical theater. A career so long and influential that it puts just one degree of separation between Oscar Hammerstein and Lin-Manuel Miranda. A little business before we go. Please leave us your comments and go take a dive into our full list of episodes. You'll find all sorts of outstanding people there. Artists, scientists, political leaders, each one with outstanding stories to tell and plenty of inspiration to go around. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement.
Heck, I'd even play the maid to be in a show. Mr. Producer, I'm talking to you, sir. I don't need a lot, only what I got, plus a tube of grease paint and a follow spot. I'm a
What It Takes is generously funded by the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for listening. See you next time.
Dreaming of the great day when I'll be in a show.